Tom Brown's School Days. Part 1, Chapter I. The Brown Family. I'm the poet of White Horse Vale, sir, with liberal notions under my cap. Ballad. The Browns have become illustrious by the pen of Thackeray and the pencil of Doyle, within the memory of the young gentlemen who are now matriculating at the universities. Notwithstanding the well-merited but late fame which has now fallen upon them, anyone at all acquainted with the family must feel that much has yet to be written and said before the British nation will be properly sensible of how much of its greatness it owes to the Browns. For centuries, in their quiet, dogged, homespun way, they have been subduing the earth in most English counties, and leaving their mark in American forests and Australian uplands. Wherever the fleets and armies of England have won renown, their stalwart sons of the Browns have done yeoman's work. With the U-bow and cloth yarn shaft at Cressy and Agincourt, with the Brown bill and pike under the brave Lord Willoughby, with culverin and demi-culverin against Spaniards and Dutchmen, with hand grenade and saber, and musket and bayonet, under Rodney and St. Vincent, Wolfe, and Moore, Nelson and Wellington, they have carried their lives in their hands, getting hard knocks and hard work in plenty, which was on the whole what they looked for, and the best thing for them in little praise or pudding, which indeed they, and most of us, are better without. Talbots and Stanleys, St. Maurers, and such like folk, have led armies and made laws time out of mind, but those noble families would be somewhat astounded if the accounts ever came to be fairly taken to find how small their work for England has been by the side of that of the Browns. These latter, indeed, have, until the present generation, rarely been sung by poet, or chronicled by sage. They have wanted their such heirs, having been too solid to rise to the top by themselves, and not having been largely gifted with the talent of catching hold of, and holding on tight to, whatever good things happen to be going the foundation of the fortunes of so many noble families. But the world goes on its way, and the wheel turns, and the wrongs of the Browns, like other wrongs, seem in a fair way to get righted. And this present writer, having for many years of his life been a devout Brown worshipper, and, moreover, having the honor of being nearly connected with an eminently respectable branch of the great Brown family, is anxious, so far as in him lies, to help the wheel over, and throw his stone onto the pile. However, gentle reader, or simple reader, whichever you may be, lest you should be led to waste your precious time upon these pages, I make so bold as at once to tell you the sort of folk you'll have to meet and put up with, if you and I are to jog on comfortably together. You shall hear at once what sort of folk the Browns are, at least my branch of them, and then, if you don't like the sort, why, cut the concern at once, and let you and I cry quits before either of us can grumble at the other. In the first place, the Browns are a fighting family. One may question their wisdom, or wit, or beauty, but about their fight there can be no question. Wherever hard knocks of any kind, visible or invisible, are going, there the Brown who is nearest must shove in his carcass. And these carcasses, for the most part, answer very well to the characteristic propensity. They are a square-headed and snake-necked generation, broad in the shoulder, deep in the chest, and thin in the flank, carrying no lumber. Then for clanship, they are as bad as Highlanders. It is amazing the belief they have in one another. With them there is nothing like the Browns, to the third and fourth generation. Blood is thicker than water, is one of their pet sayings. They can't be happy unless they are always meeting one another. Never were such people for family gatherings, which, were you a stranger, or sensitive, you might think had better not have been gathered together. For during the whole time of their being together they luxuriate in telling one another their minds on whatever subject turns up, and their minds are wonderfully antagonistic, and all their opinions are downright beliefs. Till you've been among them some time and understand them, you can't think but that they are quarreling. Not a bit of it. They love and respect one another 10 times the more after a good set family arguing bout, and go back, one to his curacy, another to his chambers, and another to his regiment, freshened for work, and more than ever convinced that the Browns are the height of company. This family training, too, combined with their turn for combativeness, makes them eminently quixotic. They can't let anything alone which they think going wrong. They must speak their mind about it, annoying all easy-going folk, and spend their time and money in having a tinker at it, however hopeless the job. It is an impossibility to a Brown to leave the most disreputable lame dog on the other side of a stile. Most other folk get tired of such work. The old Browns, with red faces, white whiskers, and bald heads, go on believing and fighting to a green old age. They have always a crotchet going, till the old man with the scythe reaps and garners them away for troublesome old boys as they are. And the most provoking thing is, that no failures knock them up, or make them hold their hands, or think you, or me, or other sane people in the right. Failures slide off them like July rain off a duck's back feathers. Jem and his whole family turn out bad, and cheat them 1 week, and the next they are doing the same thing for Jack, and when he goes to the treadmill, and his wife and children to the workhouse, they will be on the lookout for Bill to take his place. However, it is time for us to get from the general to the particular, so, leaving the great army of Browns, who are scattered over the whole empire on which the sun never sets, and whose general diffusion I take to be the chief cause of that empire's stability, let us at once fix our attention upon the small nest of Browns in which our hero was hatched, and which dwelt in that portion of the royal county of Berks which is called the Vale of White Horse. Most of you have probably travelled down the Great Western Railway as far as Swindon. Those of you who did so with their eyes open have been aware, soon after leaving the Didcot station, of a fine range of chalk hills running parallel with the railway on the left-hand side as you go down, and distant some 2 or 3 miles, more or less, from the line. The highest point in the range is the White Horse Hill, which you come in front of just before you stop at the Shrivenham station. If you love English scenery, and have a few hours to spare, you can't do better, the next time you pass, than stop at the Farringdon Road or Shrivenham station, and make your way to that highest point. And those who care for the vague old stories that haunt countrysides all about England, will not, if they are wise, be content with only a few hours' stay, for, glorious as the view is, the neighborhood is yet more interesting for its relics of bygone times. I only know 2 English neighborhoods thoroughly, and in each, within a circle of 5 miles, there is enough of interest and beauty to last any reasonable man his life. I believe this to be the case almost throughout the country, but each has a special attraction, and none can be richer than the one I am speaking of and going to introduce you to very particularly, for on this subject I must be prosy, so those that don't care for England in detail may skip the chapter. Oh, young England! Young England! You who are born into these racing railroad times, when there's a great exhibition, or some monster sight, every year, and you can get over a couple of 1,000 miles of ground for £3.10 and a 5 weeks' holiday, why don't you know more of your own birthplaces? You're all in the ends of the earth, it seems to me, as soon as you get your necks out of the educational collar, for midsummer holidays, long vacations, or whatnot going round Ireland, with the return ticket, in a fortnight, dropping your copies of Tennyson on the tops of Swiss mountains, or pulling down the Danube in Oxford racing boats. And when you get home for a quiet fortnight, you turn the steam off, and lie on your backs in the paternal garden, surrounded by the last batch of books from Moody's library, and half bored to death. Well, well. I know it has its good side. You all patter French more or less, and perhaps German, you have seen men and cities, no doubt, and have your opinions, such as they are, about schools of painting, high art, and all that, have seen the pictures of Dresden and the Louvre, and know the taste of sauerkraut. All I say is, you don't know your own lanes and woods and fields. Though you may be choke full of science, not 1 in 20 of you knows where to find the wood sorrel, or bee orchis, which grow in the next wood, or on the down 3 miles off, or what the bog bean and wood sage are good for. And as for the country legends, the stories of the old gable-ended farmhouses, the place where the last skirmish was fought in the civil wars, where the parish butts stood, where the last highwayman turned to bay, where the last ghost was laid by the parson, they're gone out of date altogether. Now, in my time, when we got home by the old coach, which put us down at the crossroads with our boxes, the first day of the holidays, and had been driven off by the family coachman, singing Dulce Domum at the top of our voices, there we were, fixtures, till Black Monday came round. We had to cut out our own amusements within a walk or a ride of home. And so we got to know all the country folk and their ways and songs and stories by heart, and went over the fields and woods and hills, again and again, till we made friends of them all. We were Berkshire, or Gloucestershire, or Yorkshire boys, and your young cosmopolites, belonging to all countries and no countries. No doubt it's all right, I dare say it is. This is the day of large views, and glorious humanity, and all that, but I wish back sword play hadn't gone out in the Vale of White Horse, and that that confounded Great Western hadn't carried away Alfred's Hill to make an embankment. But to return to the said Vale of White Horse, the country in which the first scenes of this true and interesting story are laid. As I said, the Great Western now runs right through it, and it is a land of large, rich pastures bounded by ox fences, and covered with fine hedgerow timber, with here and there a nice little gorse or spinney, where abideth poor Charlie, having no other cover to which to betake himself for miles and miles, when pushed out some fine November morning by the old Berkshire. Those who have been there, and well mounted, only know how he and the staunch little pack who dash after him heads high and sterns low, with a breast-high scent can consume the ground at such times. There being little ploughland, and few woods, the Vale is only an average sporting country, except for hunting. The villages are straggling, queer, old-fashioned places, the houses being dropped down without the least regularity, in nooks and out-of-the-way corners, by the sides of shadowy lanes and footpaths, each with its patch of garden. They are built chiefly of good gray stone, and thatched, though I see that within the last year or two the red brick cottages are multiplying, for the Vale is beginning to manufacture largely both bricks and tiles. There are lots of waste ground by the side of the roads in every village, amounting often to village greens, where feed the pigs and ganders of the people, and these roads are old-fashioned, homely roads, very dirty and badly made, and hardly endurable in winter, but still pleasant jog-trot roads running through the great pasture lands, dotted here and there with little clumps of thorns, where the sleek kine are feeding, with no fence on either side of them, and a gate at the end of each field, which makes you get out of your gig, if you keep one, and gives you a chance of looking about you every quarter of a mile. One of the moralists whom we sat under in our youth was it the great Richard Swiveller, or Mr. Stiggins says, "We are born in a Vale, and must take the consequences of being found in such a situation. These consequences I, for one, am ready to encounter. I pity people who weren't born in a Vale. I don't mean a flat country, but a Vale that is, a flat country bounded by hills. The having your hill always in view if you choose to turn towards him, that's the essence of a Vale. There he is forever in the distance, your friend and companion. You never lose him as you do in hilly districts. And then what a hill is the White Horse Hill. There it stands right up above all the rest, 900 feet above the sea, and the boldest, bravest shape for a chalk hill that you ever saw. Let us go up to the top of him, and see what is to be found there. Eh, you may well wonder and think it odd you never heard of this before, but wonder or not, as you please, there are hundreds of such things lying about England, which wiser folk than you know nothing of, and care nothing for. Yes, it's a magnificent Roman camp, and no mistake, with gates and ditch and mounds, all as complete as it was 20 years after the strong old rogues left it. Here, right up on the highest point, from which they say you can see 11 counties, they trenched round all the tableland, some 12 or 14 acres, as was their custom, for they couldn't bear anybody to overlook them, and made their eyrie. The ground falls away rapidly on all sides. Was there ever such turf in the whole world? You sink up to your ankles at every step, and yet the spring of it is delicious. There is always a breeze in the camp, as it is called, and here it lies, just as the Romans left it, except that cairn on the east side, left by Her Majesty's Corps of Sappers and Miners the other day, when they and the engineer officer had finished their sojourn there, and their surveys for the ordnance map of Berkshire. It is altogether a place that you won't forget, a place to open a man's soul, and make him prophesy, as he looks down on that great Vale spread out as the garden of the Lord before him, and wave on wave of the mysterious downs behind, and to the right and left the chalk hills running away into the distance, along which he can trace for miles the old Roman road, the Ridgeway, the Rudge, as the country folk call it, keeping straight along the highest back of the hill. Such a place as Balak brought Balaam to, and told him to prophesy against the people in the valley beneath. And he could not, neither shall you, for they are a people of the Lord who abide there. And now we leave the camp, and descend towards the west, and are on the Ashdown. We are treading on heroes. It is sacred ground for our Englishmen, more sacred than all but one or two fields where their bones lie whitening. For this is the actual place where our Alfred won his great battle, the Battle of Ashdown, he shunned him in the chroniclers, which broke the Danish power, and made England a Christian land. The Danes held the camp in the slope where we are standing, the whole crown of the hill, in fact. The heathen had beforehand seized the higher ground, as old Asser says, having wasted everything behind them from London, and being just ready to burst down on the fair Vale, Alfred's own birthplace and heritage. And up the heights came the Saxons, as they did at the Alma. The Christians led up their line from the lower ground. There stood also on that same spot a single thorn tree, marvelous stumpy, which we ourselves with our very own eyes have seen. Bless the old chronicler. Does he think nobody ever saw the single thorn tree but himself? Why, there it stands to this very day, just on the edge of the slope, and I saw it not 3 weeks since, an old single thorn tree, marvelous stumpy. At least, if it isn't the same tree it ought to have been, for it's just in the place where the battle must have been won or lost, around which, as I was saying, the two lines of Fiemen came together in battle with a huge shout. And in this place one of the two kings of the heathen and 5 of his earls fell down and died, and many thousands of the heathen sighed in the same place. After which crowning mercy, the pious king, that there might never be wanting a sign and a memorial to the countryside, carved out on the northern side of the chalk hill, under the camp, where it is almost precipitous, the great Saxon White Horse, which he who will may see from the railway, and which gives its name to the Vale, over which it has looked these 1,000 years and more. Pagani adishere meocum preoccupaverint. Christiani ab inferior I loco asim dirigebit. Erit quocan iodum loco unica spinosa arbor, brevis ad majum, quam nos ipsi nostris propriis oculus vidimus. Circa quam ergo hostiles intersaeces cum ingenti clamor hostilator convenient. Quo in loco altera de duobus paganorum regibus et quinque comites oxisi occularunt, et multimilia pagani partis in iodem loco. Cecita dilic ergo bog shagrex, et sidroc il senex comes, et sidroc junior comes, et opsburn comes, etc. dash in alrarum gestarum ilferdi magni, auctoris aereo. Recensut Franciscus Wise. Oxford, 1722. p.23. Right down below the White Horse is a curious deep and broad gully called the Manger, into one side of which the hills fall with a series of the most lovely sweeping curves, known as the Giant's Stairs. They are not a bit like stairs, but I never saw anything like them anywhere else, with their short green turf, and tender bluebells, and gossamer and thistle down gleaming in the sun and the sheep paths running along their sides like ruled lines. The other side of the Manger is formed by the Dragon's Hill, a curious little round self-confident fellow, thrown forward from the range, utterly unlike everything round him. On this hill some deliverer of mankind Saint George, the country folk used to tell me killed a dragon. Whether it were Saint George, I cannot say, but surely a dragon was killed there, for you may see the marks yet where his blood ran down, and more by token the place where it ran down is the easiest way up the hillside. Passing along the ridgeway to the west for about a mile, we come to a little clump of young beech and firs, with a growth of thorn and privet underwood. Here you may find nests of the strong down partridge and peewit, but take care that the keeper isn't down upon you, and in the middle of it is an old tromlech, a huge flat stone raised on seven or eight others, and led up to by a path, with large single stones set up on each side. This is Whale and Smith's Cave, a place of classic fame now, but as Sir Walter has touched it, I may as well let it alone, and refer you to Kenilworth for the legend. The thick, deep wood which you see in the hollow, about a mile off, surrounds Ashdown Park, built by Inigo Jones. Four broad alleys are cut through the wood from circumference to center, and each leads to one face of the house. The mystery of the downs hangs about house and wood, as they stand there alone, so unlike all around, with the green slope studded with great stones just about this part, stretching away on all sides. It was a wise Lord Craven, I think, who pitched his tent there. Passing along the ridgeway to the east, we soon come to cultivated land. The Downs, strictly so called, are no more. Lincolnshire farmers have been imported, and the long, fresh slopes are sheep walks no more, but grow famous turnips and barley. One of these improvers lives over there at the Seven Barrows Farm, another mystery of the Great Downs. There are the Barrows still, solemn and silent, like ships in the calm sea, the sepulchres of some sons of men. But of whom? It is 3 miles from the White Horse too far for the slain of Ashdown to be buried there. Who shall say what heroes are waiting there? But we must get down into the vale again, and so away by the Great Western Railway to town, for time and the printer's devil press, and it is a terrible long and slippery descent, and a shocking bad road. At the bottom, however, there is a pleasant public, whereat we must really take a modest quencher, for the down air is provocative of thirst. So we pull up under an old oak which stands before the door. What is the name of your hill, landlord? Blyngstone Hill, sir, to be sure. Reader. Stime? Author, Stone, stupid the blowing stone. And of your house. I can't make out the sign. Blyngstone, sir, says the landlord, pouring out his old ale from a Toby Philpott jug, with a melodious crash, into the long-necked glass. What queer names. Say we, sighing at the end of our draught, and holding out the glass to be replenished. Bean't queer at all, as I can see, sir, says mine host, handing back our glass, seeing as this here is the Blyngstone, hisself, putting his hand on a square lump of stone, some 3 feet and a half high, perforated with two or three queer holes, like petrified antediluvian rat holes, which lies there close under the oak, under our very nose. We are more than ever puzzled, and drink our second glass of ale, wondering what will come next. Like to hear un, sir? Says mine host, setting down Toby Philpott on the tray, and resting both hands on the stone. We are ready for anything, and he, without waiting for a reply, applies his mouth to one of the rat holes. Something must come of it, if he doesn't burst. Good heavens! I hope he has no apoplectic tendencies. Yes, here it comes, sure enough, a gruesome sound between a moan and a roar, and spreads itself away over the valley, and up the hillside, and into the woods at the back of the house, a ghost-like, awful voice. Say, sir, says mine host, rising purple-faced, while the moan is still coming out of the stwun, as they used in old times to warn the countryside by blowing the stwun when the enemy was a-coming, and as how folks could make unheard then for 7 mile round, leastways, so I've heard Lawyer Smith say, and he knows a smart sight about them old times. We can hardly swallow Lawyer Smith's 7 miles, but could the blowing of the stone have been a summons, a sort of sending the fiery cross round the neighborhood in the old times? What old times? Who knows? We pay for our beer, and are thankful. And what's the name of the village just below, landlord? Kingstone Isle, sir. Fine plantations you've got here? Yes, sir, the squire's amazing fond of trees and such like. No wonder. He's got some real beauties to be fond of. Good day, landlord. Good day, sir, and a pleasant ride to we. And now, my boys, you whom I want to get for readers, have you had enough? Will you give in at once, and say you're convinced, and let me begin my story, or will you have more of it? Remember, I've only been over a little bit of the hillside yet what you could ride round easily on your ponies in an hour. I'm only just come down into the vale, by Blowing Stone Hill, and if I once begin about the vale, what's to stop me? You'll have to hear all about Wantage, the birthplace of Alfred, and Faringdon, which held out so long for Charles I. The vale was near Oxford, and dreadfully malignant, full of Throgmortons, Buseys, and Pies, and such like, and their brawny retainers. Did you ever read Thomas Ingoldsby's Legend of Hamilton Tye? If you haven't, you ought to have. Well, Faringdon is where he lived. Before he went to sea, his real name was Hamden Pye, and the Pies were the great folk at Faringdon. Then there's Pusey. You've heard of the Pusey horn, which King Canute gave to the Puseys of that day, and which the gallant old squire, lately gone to his rest, whom Berkshire freeholders turned out of last Parliament, to their eternal disgrace, for voting according to his conscience, used to bring out on high days, holidays, and bonfire nights. And the splendid old cross church at Uffington, the Uffingas town. How the whole countryside teems with Saxon names and memories. And the old moated grange at Compton, nestled close under the hillside, where 20 Marianas may have lived, with its bright water lilies in the moat, and its yew walk, the cloister walk, and its beerless terraced gardens. There they all are, and 20 things beside, for those who care about them, and have eyes. And these are the sort of things you may find, I believe, every one of you, in any common English country neighborhood. Will you look for them under your own noses, or will you not? Well, well, I've done what I can to make you, and if you will go gadding over half Europe now, every holidays, I can't help it. I was born and bred a West Country man, thank God. A Wessex man, a citizen of the noblest Saxon kingdom of Wessex, a regular angular Saxon, the very soul of me at scriptus glebi. There's nothing like the old countryside for me, and no music like the twang of the real old Saxon tongue, as one gets it fresh from the veritable chaw in the White Horse Vale, and I say with Garge Riddler, the old West Country yeoman, dash. Through all the world I'll Garge would woost, commend me to merry old England most, while Vuls goes prating vure and nigh, we swaps at whim, my dog and I. Here, at any rate, lived and stopped at home Squire Brown, J.P. for the county of Berks, in a village near the foot of the White Horse Range. And here he dealt out justice and mercy in a rough way, and begat sons and daughters, and hunted the fox, and grumbled at the badness of the roads and the times. And his wife dealt out stockings, and calico shirts, and smock frocks, and comforting drinks to the old folks with the rheumatize, and good counsel to all, and kept the coal and clothes clubs going, for Yuletide, when the bands of mummers came round, dressed out in ribbons and colored paper caps, and stamped round the squire's kitchen, repeating in true sing-song vernacular the legend of St. George in his fight, and the 10-pound doctor, who plays his part at healing the Saint A relic, I believe, of the old Middle Age mysteries. It was the first dramatic representation which greeted the eyes of little Tom, who was brought down into the kitchen by his nurse to witness it, at the mature age of 3 years. Tom was the eldest child of his parents, and from his earliest babyhood exhibited the family characteristics in great strength. He was a hearty, strong boy from the first, given to fighting with and escaping from his nurse, and fraternizing with all the village boys, with whom he made expeditions all round the neighborhood. And here, in the quiet old-fashioned country village, under the shadow of the everlasting hills, Tom Brown was reared, and never left it till he went first to school, when nearly 8 years of age, for in those days change of air twice a year was not thought absolutely necessary for the health of all Her Majesty's lieges. I have been credibly informed, and am inclined to believe, that the various boards of directors of railway companies, those gigantic jobbers and bribers, while quarreling about everything else, agreed together some 10 years back to buy up the learned profession of medicine, body and soul. To this end they set apart several millions of money, which they continually distribute judiciously among the doctors, stipulating only this one thing, that they shall prescribe change of air to every patient who can pay, or borrow money to pay, a railway fare, and see their prescription carried out. If it be not for this, why is it that none of us can be well at home for a year together? It wasn't so 20 years ago, not a bit of it. The Browns didn't go out of the country once in 5 years. A visit to Reading or Abingdon twice a year, at assizes or quarter sessions, which the squire made on his horse with a pair of saddlebags containing his wardrobe, a stay of a day or two at some country neighbor's, or an expedition to a county ball or the yeomanry review, made up the sum of the Brown locomotion in most years. A stray Brown from some distant county dropped in every now and then, or from Oxford, on Grave Nag, an old Don, contemporary of the squire, and were looked upon by the Brown household and the villagers with the same sort of feeling with which we now regard a man who has crossed the Rocky Mountains, or launched a boat on the Great Lake in Central Africa. The White Horse Vale, remember, was traversed by no great road, nothing but country parish roads, and these very bad. Only one coach ran there, and this one only from Wantage to London, so that the western part of the vale was without regular means of moving on, and certainly didn't seem to want them. There was the canal, by the way, which supplied the countryside with coal, and up and down which continually went the long barges, with the big black men lounging by the side of the horses along the towing path, and the women in bright-colored handkerchiefs standing in the stern steering. Standing, I say, but you could never see whether they were standing or sitting, all but their heads and shoulders being out of sight in the cozy little cabins which occupied some 8 feet of the stern, and which Tom Brown pictured to himself as the most desirable of residences. His nurse told him that those good-natured-looking women were in the constant habit of enticing children into the barges, and taking them up to London and selling them, which Tom wouldn't believe, and which made him resolve as soon as possible to accept the oft-proffered invitation of these sirens to young master to come in and have a ride. But as yet the nurse was too much for Tom. Yet why should I, after all, abuse the gadabout propensities of my countrymen? We are a vagabond nation now, that's certain, for better for worse. I am a vagabond, I have been away from home no less than 5 distinct times in the last year. The Queen sets us the example, we are moving on from top to bottom. Little Dirty Jack, who abides in Clements Inn Gateway, and blacks my boots for a penny, takes his month's hop picking every year as a matter of course. Why shouldn't he? I'm delighted at it. I love vagabonds, only I prefer poor to rich ones. Couriers and ladies' maids, imperials and traveling carriages, are an abomination unto me, I cannot away with them. But for Dirty Jack, and every good fellow who, in the words of the capital French song, moves about. Comme le lima son, pour ton tout son baggage, se mubla, se maison. On his own back, why, good luck to them, and many a merry roadside adventure, and steaming supper in the chimney corners of roadside inns, Swiss chalets, Hottentot kraals, or wherever else they like to go. So, having succeeded in contradicting myself in my first chapter, which gives me great hopes that you will all go on, and think me a good fellow notwithstanding my crotchets, I shall here shut up for the present, and consider my ways, having resolved to sort it out, as we say in the Vale, holus bolus just as it comes, and then you'll probably get the truth out of me. Chapter 2 The Feast. And the King commandeth and forbiddeth, that from henceforth neither fairs nor markets be kept in churchyards, for the honor of the church. Statutes, 13 Edward I Stat. 2. Cap. Phi. As that venerable and learned poet, whose voluminous works we all think it the correct thing to admire and talk about, but don't read often, most truly says, the child is father to the man, a fortiori, therefore, he must be father to the boy. So as we are going at any rate to see Tom Brown through his boyhood, supposing we never get any farther, which, if you show a proper sense of the value of this history, there is no knowing but what we may, let us have a look at the life and environments of the child in the quiet country village to which we were introduced in the last chapter. Tom, as has been already said, was a robust and combative urchin, and at the age of 4 began to struggle against the yoke and authority of his nurse. That functionary was a good-hearted, tearful, scatterbrained girl, lately taken by Tom's mother, Madam Brown, as she was called, from the village school to be trained as nursery maid. Madam Brown was a rare trainer of servants, and spent herself freely in the profession, for profession it was, and gave her more trouble by half than many people take to earn a good income. Her servants were known and sought after for miles round. Almost all the girls who attained a certain place in the village school were taken by her, one or two at a time, as housemaids, laundry maids, nursery maids, or kitchen maids, and after a year or two's training were started in life amongst the neighboring families, with good principles and wardrobes. One of the results of this system was the perpetual despair of Mrs. Brown's cook and own maid, who no sooner had a notable girl maid to their hands than Mrs. was sure to find a good place for her and send her off, taking in fresh importations from the school. Another was, that the house was always full of young girls, with clean, shining faces, who broke plates and scorched linen, but made an atmosphere of cheerful, homely life about the place, good for everyone who came within its influence. Mrs. Brown loved young people, and in fact human creatures in general, above plates and linen. They were more like a lot of elder children than servants, and felt to her more as a mother or aunt than as a mistress. Tom's nurse was one who took in her instruction very slowly. She seemed to have two left hands and no head, and so Mrs. Brown kept her on longer than usual, that she might expend her awkwardness and forgetfulness upon those who would not judge and punish her too strictly for them. Charity Lamb was her name. It had been the immemorial habit of the village to christen children either by Bible names, or by those of the cardinal and other virtues, so that one was forever hearing in the village street or on the green, shrill sounds of Prudence. Prudence. Thee come out of the gutter, or, Mercy. Drat the girl, what bist thee a doin' why little Faith? And there were Ruths, Rachels, Kezias, in every corner. The same with the boys, they were Benjamins, Jacobs, Noahs, Enochs. I suppose the custom has come down from Puritan times. There it is, at any rate, very strong still in the Vale. Well, from early morning till dewy eve, when she had it out of him in the cold tub before putting him to bed, Charity and Tom were pitted against one another. Physical power was as yet on the side of Charity, but she hadn't a chance with him wherever headwork was wanted. This war of independence began every morning before breakfast, when Charity escorted her charge to a neighboring farmhouse, which supplied the Browns, and where, by his mother's wish, Master Tom went to drink whey before breakfast. Tom had no sort of objection to whey, but he had a decided liking for curds, which were forbidden as unwholesome, and there was seldom a morning that he did not manage to secure a handful of hard curds, in defiance of Charity and of the farmer's wife. The latter good soul was a gaunt, angular woman, who, with an old black bonnet on the top of her head, the strings dangling about her shoulders, and her gown tucked through her pocket holes, went clattering about the dairy, cheese room, and yard, in high pattens. Charity was some sort of niece of the old lady's, and was consequently free of the farmhouse and garden, into which she could not resist going for the purposes of gossip and flirtation with the heir apparent, who was a dawdling fellow, never out at work as he ought to have been. The moment Charity had found her cousin, or any other occupation, Tom would slip away, and in a minute shrill cries would be heard from the dairy, "Charity, Charity, thee lazy hussy, where bist?" And Tom would break cover, hands and mouth full of curds, and take refuge on the shaky surface of the great muck reservoir in the middle of the yard, disturbing the repose of the great pigs. Here he was in safety, as no grown person could follow without getting over their knees, and the luckless Charity, while her aunt scolded her from the dairy door, for being all as hankering about Arter R. Willem, instead of minding Master Tom, would descend from threats to coaxing, to lure Tom out of the muck, which was rising over his shoes, and would soon tell a tale on his stockings, for which she would be sure to catch it from Mrs.'s maid. Tom had two abettors, in the shape of a couple of old boys, Noah and Benjamin by name, who defended him from Charity, and expended much time upon his education. They were both of them retired servants of former generations of the Browns. Noah Crook was a keen, dry old man of almost 90, but still able to totter about. He talked to Tom quiet as if he were one of his own family, and indeed had long completely identified the Browns with himself. In some remote age he had been the attendant of a Miss Brown, and had conveyed her about the country on a pillion. He had a little round picture of the identical gray horse, caparisoned with the identical pillion, before which he used to do a sort of fetish worship, and abuse turnpike roads and carriages. He wore an old full-bottomed wig, the gift of some dandy old Brown whom he had valeted in the middle of last century, which habiliment Master Tom looked upon with considerable respect, not to say fear, and indeed his whole feeling towards Noah was strongly tainted with awe. And when the old gentleman was gathered to his father's, Tom's lamentation over him was not unaccompanied by a certain joy at having seen the last of the wig. "Poor old Noah, dead and gone," said he, "Tom Brown so sorry. Put him in the coffin, wig and all." But old Benji was young master's real delight and refuge. He was a youth by the side of Noah, scarce 70 years old, a cheery, humorous, kind-hearted old man, full of 60 years of veiled gossip, and of all sorts of helpful ways for young and old, but above all for children. It was he who bent the first pin with which Tom extracted his first stickleback out of Pebbly Brook, the little stream which ran through the village. The first stickleback was a splendid fellow, with fabulous red and blue gills. Tom kept him in a small basin till the day of his death, and became a fisherman from that day. Within a month from the taking of the first stickleback, Benji had carried off our hero to the canal, in defiance of charity, and between them, after a whole afternoon's popjoying, they had caught three or four small, coarse fish and a perch, averaging perhaps 2.5 ounces each, which Tom bore home in rapture to his mother as a precious gift, and which she received like a true mother with equal rapture, instructing the cook nevertheless, in a private interview, not to prepare the same for the squire's dinner. Charity had appealed against old Benji in the meantime, representing the dangers of the canal banks, but Mrs. Brown, seeing the boy's ineptitude for female guidance, had decided in Benji's favor, and from thenceforth the old man was Tom's dry nurse. And as they sat by the canal watching their little green and white float, Benji would instruct him in the doings of deceased Browns. How his grandfather, in the early days of the Great War, when there was much distress and crime in the Vale, and the magistrates had been threatened by the mob, had ridden in with a big stick in his hand, and held the petty sessions by himself. How his great uncle, the rector, had encountered and laid the last ghost, who had frightened the old women, male and female, of the parish out of their senses, and who turned out to be the blacksmith's apprentice disguised in drink and a white sheet. It was Benji, too, who saddled Tom's first pony, and instructed him in the mysteries of horsemanship, teaching him to throw his weight back and keep his hand low, and who stood chuckling outside the door of the girls' school when Tom rode his little Shetland into the cottage and round the table, where the old dame and her pupils were seated at their work. Benji himself was come of a family distinguished in the Vale for their prowess in all athletic games. Some half-dozen of his brothers and kinsmen had gone to the wars, of whom only one had survived to come home, with a small pension, and 3 bullets in different parts of his body. He had shared Benji's cottage till his death, and had left him his old dragoon's sword and pistol, which hung over the mantelpiece, flanked by a pair of heavy single sticks with which Benji himself had won renown long ago as an old gamester, against the picked men of Wiltshire and Somersetshire, in many a good bout at the revels and pastimes of the countryside. For he had been a famous backswordman in his young days, and a good wrestler at elbow and collar. Backswording and wrestling were the most serious holiday pursuits of the Vale, those by which men attain fame, and each village had its champion. I suppose that, on the whole, people were less worked than they are now. At any rate, they seemed to have more time and energy for the old pastimes. The great times for backswording came round once a year in each village, at the feast. The Vale feasts were not the common statute feasts, but much more ancient business. They are literally, so far as one can ascertain, feasts of the dedication, that is, they were first established in the churchyard on the day on which the village church was opened for public worship, which was on the wake or festival of the patron saint, and have been held on the same day in every year since that time. There was no longer any remembrance of why the feast had been instituted, but nevertheless it had a pleasant and almost sacred character of its own, for it was then that all the children of the village, wherever they were scattered, tried to get home for a holiday to visit their fathers and mothers and friends, bringing with them their wages or some little gift from up the country for the old folk. Perhaps for a day or two before, but at any rate on feast day and the day after, in our village, you might see strapping, healthy young men and women from all parts of the country going round from house to house in their best clothes, and finishing up with a call on Madam Brown, whom they would consult as to putting out their earnings to the best advantage, or how best to expend the same for the benefit of the old folk. Every household, however poor, managed to raise a feast cake and a bottle of ginger or raisin wine, which stood on the cottage table ready for all comers, and not unlikely to make them remember feast time, for feast cake is very solid, and full of huge raisins. Moreover, feast time was the day of reconciliation for the parish. If Job Higgins and Noah Freeman hadn't spoken for the last 6 months, their old women would be sure to get it patched up by that day. And though there was a good deal of drinking and low vice in the booths of an evening, it was pretty well confined to those who would have been doing the like, feast or no feast, and on the whole, the effect was humanizing and Christian. In fact, the only reason why this is not the case still is that gentlefolk and farmers have taken to other amusements, and have, as usual, forgotten the poor. They don't attend the feasts themselves, and call them disreputable, whereupon the steadiest of the poor leave them also, and they become what they are called. Class amusements, be they for dukes or ploughboys, always become nuisances and curses to a country. The true charm of cricket and hunting is that they are still more or less sociable and universal. There's a place for every man who will come and take his part. No one in the village enjoyed the approach of feast day more than Tom, in the year in which he was taken under old Benji's tutelage. The feast was held in a large green field at the lower end of the village. The road to Farringdon ran along one side of it, and the brook by the side of the road, and above the brook was another large, gentle, sloping pasture land, with a footpath running down it from the churchyard, and the old church, the originator of all the mirth, towered up with its grey walls and lancet windows, overlooking and sanctioning the whole, though its own share therein had been forgotten. At the point where the footpath crossed the brook and road, and entered on the field where the feast was held, was a long, low roadside inn, and on the opposite side of the field was a large white thatched farmhouse, where dwelt an old sporting farmer, a great promoter of the revels. Past the old church, and down the footpath, pottered the old man and the child hand in hand early on the afternoon of the day before the feast, and wandered all round the ground, which was already being occupied by the cheapjacks, with their green-covered carts and marvellous assortment of wares, and the booths of more legitimate small traders, with their tempting arrays of fairings and eatables, and penny peep shows and other shows, containing pink-eyed ladies, and dwarfs, and boa constrictors, and wild Indians. But the object of most interest to Benji, and of course to his pupil also, was the stage of rough planks some 4 feet high, which was being put up by the village carpenter for the back sorting and wrestling. And after surveying the whole tenderly, old Benji led his charge away to the roadside inn, where he ordered a glass of ale and a long pipe for himself, and discussed these unwonted luxuries on the bench outside in the soft autumn evening with mine host, another old servant of the Browns, and speculated with him on the likelihood of a good show of old gamesters to contend for the morrow's prizes, and told tales of the gallant bouts of 40 years back, to which Tom listened with all his ears and eyes. But who shall tell the joy of the next morning, when the church bells were ringing a merry peal, and old Benji appeared in the servants' hall, resplendent in a long blue coat and brass buttons, and a pair of old yellow buckskins and top boots which he had cleaned for and inherited from Tom's grandfather, a stout thorn stick in his hand, and a nosegay of pinks and lavender in his buttonhole, and led away Tom in his best clothes, and 2 new shillings in his breeches pockets. Those two, at any rate, look like enjoying the day's revel. They quicken their pace when they get into the churchyard, for already they see the field thronged with country folk, the men in clean, white smocks or velveteen or fustian coats, with rough plush waistcoats of many colors, and the women in the beautiful, long scarlet cloak, the usual outdoor dress of West Country women in those days, and which often descended in families from mother to daughter, or a new-fashioned stuff shawls, which, if they would but believe it, don't become them half so well. The air resounds with the pipe and tabor, and the drums and trumpets of the showmen shouting at the doors of their caravans, over which tremendous pictures of the wonders to be seen within hang temptingly, while through all rises the shrill root-too-too-too of Mr. Punch, and the unceasing pan-pipe of his satellite. "Lawkamassy, Mr. Benjamin," cries a stout, motherly woman in a red cloak, as they enter the field, "be that you? Well, I never. You do look purely. And how's the squire, and madam, and the family?" Benji graciously shakes hands with the speaker, who has left our village for some years, but has come over for feast day on a visit to an old gossip, and gently indicates the heir apparent of the Browns. "Bless his little heart. I must gi' un a kiss. Here, Susanna, Susanna," cries she, raising herself from the embrace, "come and see Mr. Benjamin and young Master Tom. You minds our Suki, Mr. Benjamin, she be growed a rare slip of a wench since you seen her, though her'll be 16 come Martinmas. I do aim to take her to see madam to get her a place." And Suki comes bouncing away from a knot of old schoolfellows, and drops a curtsy to Mr. Benjamin. And elders come up from all parts to salute Benji, and girls who have been madam's pupils to kiss Master Tom. And they carry him off to load him with fairings, and he returns to Benji, his hat and coat covered with ribbons, and his pockets crammed with wonderful boxes which open upon ever new boxes, and popguns, and trumpets, and apples, and gilt gingerbread from the stall of Angel Heavens, sole vendor thereof, whose booth groans with kings and queens, and elephants and prancing steeds, all gleaming with gold. There was more gold on angels' cakes than there is ginger in those of this degenerate age. Skill diggers might yet make a fortune in the churchyards of the Vale, by carefully washing the dust of the consumers of angels' gingerbread. Alas! He is with his namesakes, and his receipts have, I fear, died with him. And then they inspect the penny peep show at least Tom does, while old Benji stands outside and gossips and walks up the steps, and enters the mysterious doors of the pink-eyed lady and the Irish giant, who do not by any means come up to their pictures, and the boa will not swallow his rabbit, but there the rabbit is waiting to be swallowed, and what can you expect for tuppence? We are easily pleased in the Vale. Now there is a rush of the crowd, and a tinkling bell is heard, and shouts of laughter, and Master Tom mounts on Benji's shoulders, and beholds a jingling match in all its glory. The games are begun, and this is the opening of them. It is a quaint game, immensely amusing to look at, and as I don't know whether it is used in your counties, I had better describe it. A large roped ring is made, into which are introduced a dozen or so of big boys and young men who mean to play. These are carefully blinded and turned loose into the ring, and then a man is introduced not blindfolded, with the bell hung round his neck, and his two hands tied behind him. Of course every time he moves the bell must ring, as he has no hand to hold it, and so the dozen blindfolded men have to catch him. This they cannot always manage if he is a lively fellow, but half of them always rush into the arms of the other half, or drive their heads together, or tumble over, and then the crowd laughs vehemently, and invents nicknames for them on the spur of the moment, and they, if they be choleric, tear off the handkerchiefs which blind them, and not unfrequently pitch into one another, each thinking that the other must have run against him on purpose. It is great fun to look at a jingling match certainly, and Tom shouts and jumps on old Benji's shoulders at the sight, until the old man feels weary, and shifts him to the strong young shoulders of the groom, who has just got down to the fun. And now, while they are climbing the pole in another part of the field, and muzzling in a flour tub in another, the old farmer whose house, as has been said, overlooks the field, and who is master of the revels, gets up the steps onto the stage, and announces to all whom it may concern that a half-sovereign in money will be forthcoming to the old gamester who breaks most heads, to which the squire and he have added a new hat. The amount of the prize is sufficient to stimulate the men of the immediate neighborhood, but not enough to bring any very high talent from a distance, so, after a glance or two round, a tall fellow, who is Adon Shepherd, chucks his hat onto the stage and climbs up the steps, looking rather sheepish. The crowd, of course, first cheer, and then chaff as usual, as he picks up his hat and begins handling the sticks to see which will suit him. "Wui, Willem Smith, thee canst play why he are a day," says his companion to the blacksmith's apprentice, a stout young fellow of 19 or 20. Willem's sweetheart is in the veest somewhere, and has strictly enjoined him not to get his head broke at back sorting, on pain of her highest displeasure, but as she is not to be seen, the women pretend not to like to see the backsword play, and keep away from the stage, and as his hat is decidedly getting old, he chucks it onto the stage, and follows himself, hoping that he will only have to break other people's heads, or that, after all, Rachel won't really mind. Then follows the greasy cap lined with fur of a half-gypsy, poaching, loafing fellow, who travels the vale not for much good, I fancy. For 20 times was Peter feared for once that Peter was respected. In fact. And then 3 or 4 other hats, including the glossy caster of Joe Willis, the self-elected and would-be champion of the neighborhood, a well-to-do young butcher of 28 or thereabouts, and a great strapping fellow, with his full allowance of bluster. This is a capital show of gamesters, considering the amount of the prize, so, while they are picking their sticks and drawing their lots, I think I must tell you, as shortly as I can, how the noble old game of backsword is played, for it has sadly gone out of late, even in the vale, and maybe you have never seen it. The weapon is a good stout ash stick with a large basket handle, heavier and somewhat shorter than a common single stick. The players are called old gamesters. Why, I can't tell you, and their object is simply to break one another's heads, for the moment that blood runs an inch anywhere above the eyebrow, the old gamester to whom it belongs is beaten, and has to stop. A very slight blow with the sticks will fetch blood, so that it is by no means a punishing pastime, if the men don't play on purpose and savagely at the body and arms of their adversaries. The old gamester going into action only takes off his hat and coat, and arms himself with a stick. He then loops the fingers of his left hand in a handkerchief or strap, which he fastens round his left leg, measuring the length, so that when he draws it tight with his left elbow in the air, that elbow shall just reach as high as his crown. Thus you see, so long as he chooses to keep his left elbow up, regardless of cuts, he has a perfect guard for the left side of his head. Then he advances his right hand above and in front of his head, holding his stick across, so that its point projects an inch or two over his left elbow, and thus his whole head is completely guarded, and he faces his man armed in like manner, and they stand some 3 feet apart, often nearer, and feint, and strike, and return at one another's heads, until one cries hold, or blood flows. In the first case they are allowed a minute's time, and go on again, in the latter another pair of gamesters are called on. If good men are playing, the quickness of the returns is marvelous. You hear the rattle like that a boy makes drawing his stick along palings, only heavier, and the closeness of the men in action to one another gives it a strange interest, and makes a spell at back sorting a very noble sight. They are all suited now with sticks, and Joe Willis and the Gypsy Man have drawn the first lot. So the rest lean against the rails of the stage, and Joe and the Dark Man meet in the middle, the boards having been strewed with sawdust, Joe's white shirt and spotless drab breeches and boots contrasting with the Gypsy's coarse blue shirt and dirty green velveteen breeches and leather gaiters. Joe is evidently turning up his nose at the other, and half insulted at having to break his head. The Gypsy is a tough, active fellow, but not very skillful with his weapon, so that Joe's weight and strength tell in a minute, he is too heavy metal for him. Whack, 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 come his blows, breaking down the Gypsy's guard, and threatening to reach his head every moment. There it is at last. Blood, blood! Shout the spectators, as a thin stream oozes out slowly from the roots of his hair, and the umpire calls to them to stop. The Gypsy scowls at Joe under his brows in no pleasant manner, while Master Joe swaggers about, and makes attitudes, and thinks himself, and shows that he thinks himself, the greatest man in the field. Then follow several stout sets to between the other candidates for the new hat, and at last come the Shepherd and Willem Smith. This is the crack set two of the day. They are both in famous wind, and there is no crying hold. The Shepherd is an old hand, and up to all the dodges. He tries them one after another, and very nearly gets at Willem's head by coming in near, and playing over his guard at the half stick, but somehow Willem blunders through, catching the stick on his shoulders, neck, sides, every now and then, anywhere but on his head, and his returns are heavy and straight, and he is the youngest gamester and a favorite in the parish, and his gallant stand brings down shouts and cheers, and the knowing ones think he'll win if he keeps steady, and Tom, on the groom's shoulder, holds his hands together, and can hardly breathe for excitement. Alas for Willem. His sweetheart, getting tired of female companionship, has been hunting the booths to see where he can have got to, and now catches sight of him on the stage in full combat. She flushes and turns pale, her old aunt catches hold of her, saying, "Bless ye, child, don't ye go anigst it," but she breaks away and runs towards the stage calling his name. Willem keeps up his guard stoutly, but glances for a moment towards the voice. No guard will do it, Willem, without the eye. The Shepherd steps round and strikes, and the point of his stick just grazes Willem's forehead, fetching off the skin, and the blood flows, and the umpire cries, "Hold!" And poor Willem's chance is up for the day. But he takes it very well, and puts on his old hat and coat, and goes down to be scolded by his sweetheart, and led away out of mischief. Tom hears him say coaxingly, as he walks off, "Dash! Now to Auntie, Rachel. I wouldn't ha' done it, only I wanted some you to buy ye a fairing wye, and I be as flush o' money as a toot o' feathers." "Thee mind what I tells ye," rejoins Rachel saucily, and Awandi kept blethering about fairings. Tom resolves in his heart to give Willem the remainder of his 2 shillings after the back sorting. Joe Willis has all the luck today. His next bout ends in an easy victory, while the Shepherd has a tough job to break his second head, and when Joe and the Shepherd meet, and the whole circle expect and hope to see him get a broken crown, the Shepherd slips in the first round and falls against the rails, hurting himself so that the old farmer will not let him go on, much as he wishes to try, and that impostor Joe, for he is certainly not the best man, struts and swaggers about the stage the conquering gamester, though he hasn't had 5 minutes really trying play. Joe takes the new hat in his hand, and puts the money into it, and then, as if a thought strikes him, and he doesn't think his victory quite acknowledged down below, walks to each face of the stage, and looks down, shaking the money, and chaffing, as how he'll stake hat and money and another half sovereign again any gamester as hasn't played already. Cunning Joe. He thus gets rid of Willem and the Shepherd, who is quite fresh again. No one seems to like the offer, and the umpire is just coming down, when a queer old hat, something like a Doctor of Divinity's shovel, is chucked onto the stage and an elderly, quiet man steps out, who has been watching the play, saying he should like to cross a stick why the prodigalish young chap. The crowd cheer, and begin to chaff Joe, who turns up his nose and swaggers across to the sticks. "Impn old wasbird," says he, "I'll break the bald head on unto the truth." The old boy is very bald, certainly, and the blood will show fast enough if you can touch him, Joe. He takes off his long flapped coat, and stands up in a long flapped waistcoat, which Sir Roger de Coverley might have worn when it was new, picks out a stick, and is ready for Master Joe, who loses no time, but begins his old game, whack, 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 trying to break down the old man's guard by sheer strength. But it won't do, he catches every blow close by the basket, and though he is rather stiff in his returns, after a minute walks Joe about the stage, and is clearly a staunch old gamester. Joe now comes in, and making the most of his height, tries to get over the old man's guard at half stick, by which he takes a smart blow in the ribs and another on the elbow, and nothing more. And now he loses wind and begins to puff, and the crowd laugh. Cry hold, Joe, thee'st met thy match. Instead of taking good advice and getting his wind, Joe loses his temper, and strikes at the old man's body. Blood, blood! Shout the crowd, Joe's head's broke. Who'd have thought it? How did it come? That body blow left Joe's head unguarded for a moment, and with one turn of the wrist the old gentleman has picked a neat little bit of skin off the middle of his forehead, and though he won't believe it, and hammers on for three more blows despite of the shouts, is then convinced by the blood trickling into his eye. Poor Joe is sadly crestfallen, and fumbles in his pocket for the other half sovereign, but the old gamester won't have it. Keep thy money, man, and gie's thy hand, says he, and they shake hands. But the old gamester gives the new hat to the shepherd, and, soon after, the half-sovereign to Willem, who there outdecorates his sweetheart with ribbons to his heart's content. Who can a be? Where do a come from? Ask the crowd. And it soon flies about that the old West Country champion, who played a tie with Shaw the lifeguardsman advises 20 years before, has broken Joe Willis's crown for him. How my country fair is spinning out! I see I must skip the wrestling, and the boys jumping in sacks, and rolling wheelbarrows blindfolded, and the donkey race, and the fight which arose thereout, marring the otherwise peaceful feast, and the frightened scurrying away of the female feast-goers, and descent of Squire Brown, summoned by the wife of one of the combatants to stop it, which he wouldn't start to do till he had got on his top boots. Tom is carried away by old Benji, dog-tired and surfeited with pleasure, as the evening comes on and the dancing begins in the booths, and though Willem, and Rachel in her new ribbons, and many another good lad and lass don't come away just yet, but have a good step out, and enjoy it, and get no harm thereby, yet we, being sober folk, will just stroll away up through the churchyard, and by the old yew tree, and get a quiet dish of tea and a parley with our gossips, as the steady ones of our village do, and so to bed. That's the fair, true sketch, as far as it goes, of one of the larger village feasts in the Vale of Berks, when I was a little boy. They are much altered for the worse, I am told. I haven't been at one these 20 years, but I have been at the statute fairs in some West Country towns, where servants are hired, and greater abominations cannot be found. What village feasts have come to, I fear, in many cases, may be read in the pages of Yeast, though I never saw one so bad, thank God. Do you want to know why? It is because, as I said before, gentlefolk and farmers have left off joining or taking an interest in them. They don't either subscribe to the prizes, or go down and enjoy the fun. Is this a good or a bad sign? I hardly know. Bad, sure enough, if it only arises from the further separation of classes consequent on 20 years of buying cheap and selling dear, and its accompanying overwork, or because our sons and daughters have their hearts in London club life, or so-called society, instead of in the old English home duties, because farmers' sons are aping fine gentlemen, and farmers' daughters caring more to make bad foreign music than good English cheeses. Good, perhaps, if it be that the time for the old feast has gone by, that it is no longer the healthy, sound expression of English country holiday-making, that, in fact, we, as a nation, have got beyond it, and are in a transition state, feeling for and soon likely to find some better substitute. Only I have just got this to say before I quit the text. Don't let reformers of any sort think that they are going really to lay hold of the working boys and young men of England by any educational grapnel whatever, which isn't some bona fide equivalent for the games of the old country of East in it, something to put in the place of the back-sorting and wrestling and racing, something to try the muscles of men's bodies, and the endurance of their hearts, and to make them rejoice in their strength. In all the newfangled comprehensive plans which I see, this is all left out, and the consequence is, that your great mechanics institutes and an intellectual priggism, and your Christian young men's societies and religious Pharisaism. Well, well, we must bide our time. Life isn't all beer and skittles, but beer and skittles, or something better of the same sort, must form a good part of every Englishman's education. If I could only drive this into the heads of you rising parliamentary lords, and young swells who have your ways made for you, as the saying is, you, who frequent palaver houses and West End clubs, waiting always ready to strap yourselves onto the back of poor dear old John, as soon as the present used-up lot, your fathers and uncles, who sit there on the great parliamentary majority's pack saddle, and make believe they're guiding him with their red tape bridle, tumble, or have to be lifted off. I don't think much of you yet. I wish I could, though you do go talking and lecturing up and down the country to crowded audiences, and are busy with all sorts of philanthropic intellectualism, and circulating libraries and museums, and heaven only knows what besides, and try to make us think, through newspaper reports, that you are, even as we, of the working classes. But bless your hearts, we ain't so green, though lots of us of all sorts dote you enough certainly, and try to make you think so. I'll tell you what to do now, instead of all this trumpeting and fuss, which is only the old parliamentary majority dodge over again. Just you go, each of you, you've plenty of time for it, if you'll only give up t'other line, and quietly make three or four friends real friends among us. You'll find a little trouble in getting at the right sort, because such birds don't come lightly to your lure, but found they may be. Take, say, two out of the professions, lawyer, parson, doctor which you will, one out of trade, and three or four out of the working classes, tailors, engineers, carpenters, engravers. There's plenty of choice. Let them be men of your own ages, mind, and ask them to your homes, introduce them to your wives and sisters, and get introduced to theirs, give them good dinners, and talk to them about what is really at the bottom of your hearts, and box, and run, and row with them, when you have a chance. Do all this honestly as man to man, and by the time you come to ride old John, you'll be able to do something more than sit on his back, and may feel his mouth with some stronger bridle than a red tape one. Ah, if you only would. But you have got too far out of the right rut, I fear. Too much over civilization, and the deceitfulness of riches. It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. More's the pity. I never came across but two of you who could value a man wholly and solely for what was in him, who thought themselves verily and indeed of the same flesh and blood as John Jones the attorney's clerk, and Bill Smith the costermonger, and could act as if they thought so. Chapter 3 Sundry Wars and Alliances. Poor old Benji. The rheumatize has much to answer for all through English countrysides, but it never played a scurvier trick than in laying thee by the heels, when thou wast yet in a green old age. The enemy, which had long been carrying on a sort of border warfare, and trying his strength against Benji's on the battlefield of his hands and legs, now, mustering all his forces, began laying siege to the citadel, and overrunning the whole country. Benji was seized in the back and loins, and though he made strong and brave fight, it was soon clear enough that all which could be beaten of poor old Benji would have to give in before long. It was as much as he could do now, with the help of his big stick and frequent stops, to hobble down to the canal with Master Tom, and bait his hook for him, and sit and watch his angling, telling him quaint old country stories, and when Tom had no sport, and detecting a rat some 100 yards or so off along the bank, would rush off with Toby the turnspit terrier, his other faithful companion, in bootless pursuit. He might have tumbled in and been drowned 20 times over before Benji could have got near him. Cheery and unmindful of himself, as Benji was, this loss of locomotive power bothered him greatly. He had got a new object in his old age, and was just beginning to think himself useful again in the world. He feared much, too, lest Master Tom should fall back again into the hands of Charity and the women. So he tried everything he could think of to get set up. He even went an expedition to the dwelling of one of those queer mortals, who say what we will, and reason how we will do cure simple people of diseases of one kind or another without the aid of physic, and so get to themselves the reputation of using charms, and inspire for themselves and their dwellings great respect, not to say fear, amongst a simple folk such as the dwellers in the Vale of White Horse. Where this power, or whatever else it may be, descends upon the shoulders of a man whose ways are not straight, he becomes a nuisance to the neighborhood, a receiver of stolen goods, giver of love potions, and deceiver of silly women, the avowed enemy of law and order, of justices of the peace, head boroughs, and gamekeepers, such a man, in fact, as was recently caught tripping, and deservedly dealt with by the Leeds justices, for seducing a girl who had come to him to get back a faithless lover, and has been convicted of bigamy since then. Sometimes, however, they are of quite a different stamp, men who pretend to nothing, and are with difficulty persuaded to exercise their occult arts in the simplest cases. Of this latter sort was old Farmer Ives, as he was called, the wise man to whom Benji resorted, taking Tom with him as usual, in the early spring of the year next after the feast described in the last chapter. Why he was called Farmer I cannot say, unless it be that he was the owner of a cow, a pig or two, and some poultry, which he maintained on about an acre of land enclosed from the middle of a wild common, on which probably his father had squatted before lords of manors looked as keenly after their rights as they do now. Here he had lived no one knew how long, a solitary man. It was often rumored that he was to be turned out and his cottage pulled down, but somehow it never came to pass, and his pigs and cow went grazing on the common, And his geese hissed at the passing children and at the heels of the horse of my lord's steward, who often rode by with a covetous eye on the enclosure still unmolested. His dwelling was some miles from our village, so Benji, who was half ashamed of his errand, and wholly unable to walk there, had to exercise much ingenuity to get the means of transporting himself and Tom thither without exciting suspicion. However, one fine May morning he managed to borrow the old blind pony of our friend the publican, and Tom persuaded Madam Brown to give him a holiday to spend with old Benji, and to lend them the squire's light cart, stored with bread and cold meat and a bottle of ale. And so the two in high glee started behind old Dobbin, and jogged along the deep-rutted plashy roads, which had not been mended after their winter's wear, towards the dwelling of the wizard. About noon they passed the gate which opened onto the large common, and old Dobbin toiled slowly up the hill, while Benji pointed out a little deep dingle on the left, out of which welled a tiny stream. As they crept up the hill the tops of a few birch trees came in sight, and blue smoke curling up through their delicate light boughs, and then the little white thatched home and enclosed ground of Farmer Ives, lying cradled in the dingle, with the gay gorse common rising behind and on both sides, while in front, after traversing a gentle slope, the eye might travel for miles and miles over the rich vale. They now left the main road and struck into a green track over the common marked lightly with wheel and horseshoe, which led down into the dingle and stopped at the rough gate of Farmer Ives. Here they found the farmer, an iron-gray old man, with a bushy eyebrow and strong aquiline nose, busied in one of his vocations. He was a horse and cow doctor, and was tending a sick beast which had been sent up to be cured. Benji hailed him as an old friend, and he returned the greeting cordially enough, looking however hard for a moment both at Benji and Tom, to see whether there was more in their visit than appeared at first sight. It was a work of some difficulty and danger for Benji to reach the ground, which, however, he managed to do without mishap, and then he devoted himself to unharnessing Dobbin and turning him out for a graze, a run one could not say of that virtuous steed, on the common. This done, he extricated the cold provisions from the cart, and they entered the farmer's wicket, and he, shutting up the knife with which he was taking maggots out of the cow's back and sides, accompanied them towards the cottage. A big old lurcher got up slowly from the door stone, stretching first one hind leg and then the other, and taking Tom's caresses and the presence of Toby, who kept, however, at a respectful distance, with equal indifference. Us be come to pay ye a visit. I've a been long-minded to dot for old sake's sake, only I've ins I'd won't get about now as I'd used tot. I be so plaguey bad white rheumatize in my back. Benji paused, in hopes of drawing the farmer at once on the subject of his ailments without further direct application. Ah, I see as you been quite so lissom as you was, replied the farmer, with a grim smile, as he lifted the latch of his door, we been so young as we was, new to on us, wis luck. The farmer's cottage was very like those of the better class of peasantry in general. A snug chimney corner with two seats, and a small carpet on the hearth, an old flint gun and a pair of spurs over the fireplace, a dresser with shelves on which some bright pewter plates and crockeryware were arranged, an old walnut table, a few chairs and settles, some framed samplers, and an old print or two, and a bookcase with some dozen volumes on the walls, a rack with flitches of bacon, and other stores fastened to the ceiling, and you have the best part of the furniture. No sign of a cult art is to be seen, unless the bundles of dried herbs hanging to the rack and in the ingle and the row of labeled files on one of the shelves betoken it. Tom played about with some kittens who occupied the hearth, and with a goat who walked demurely in at the open door while their host and Benji spread the table for dinner and was soon engaged in conflict with the cold meat, to which he did much honor. The two old men's talk was of old comrades and their deeds, mute and glorious Miltons of the Vale, and of the doings 30 years back, which didn't interest him much, except when they spoke of the making of the canal, and then indeed he began to listen with all his ears, and learned, to his no small wonder, that his dear and wonderful canal had not been there always was not, in fact, so old as Benji or Farmer Ives, which caused a strange commotion in his small brain. After dinner Benji called attention to a wart which Tom had on the knuckles of his hand, and which the family doctor had been trying his skill on without success, and begged the farmer to charm it away. Farmer Ives looked at it, muttered something or another over it, and cut some notches in a short stick, which he handed to Benji, giving him instructions for cutting it down on certain days, and cautioning Tom not to meddle with a wart for a fortnight. And then they strolled out and sat on a bench in the sun with their pipes, and the pigs came up and grunted sociably and let Tom scratch them, and the farmer, seeing how he liked animals, stood up and held his arms in the air, and gave a call, which brought a flock of pigeons wheeling and dashing through the birch trees. They settled down in clusters on the farmer's arms and shoulders, making love to him and scrambling over one another's backs to get to his face, and then he threw them all off, and they fluttered about close by, and lighted on him again and again when he held up his arms. All the creatures about the place were clean and fearless, quite unlike their relations elsewhere, and Tom begged to be taught how to make all the pigs and cows and poultry in our village tame, at which the farmer only gave one of his grim chuckles. It wasn't till they were just ready to go, and old Dobbin was harnessed, that Benji broached the subject of his rheumatism again, detailing his symptoms one by one. Poor old boy. He hoped the farmer could charm it away as easily as he could Tom's wart, and was ready with equal faith to put another notched stick into his other pocket, for the cure of his own ailments. The physician shook his head, but nevertheless produced a bottle, and handed it to Benji, with instructions for use. Not as teal do e much good least was I be afeard not, shading his eyes with his hand, and looking up at them in the cart. There's only one thing as I knows on as'll cure old folks like you and I th rheumatize. What be that then, farmer? Inquired Benji. Churchyard mold, said the old iron gray man, with another chuckle. And so they said their goodbyes and went their ways home. Tom's wart was gone in a fortnight, but not so Benji's rheumatism, which laid him by the heels more and more. And though Tom still spent many an hour with him, as he sat on a bench in the sunshine, or by the chimney corner when it was cold, he soon had to seek elsewhere for his regular companions. Tom had been accustomed often to accompany his mother in her visits to the cottages, and had thereby made acquaintance with many of the village boys of his own age. There was Job Rudkin, son of Widow Rudkin, the most bustling woman in the parish. How she could ever have had such a stolid boy as Job for a child must always remain a mystery. The first time Tom went to their cottage with his mother, Job was not indoors, but he entered soon after, and stood with both hands in his pockets, staring at Tom. Widow Rudkin, who would have had to cross Madam to get at young Hopeful a breach of good manners of which she was wholly incapable, began a series of pantomime signs, which only puzzled him, and at last, unable to contain herself longer, burst out with, "Job! Job! Where's thy cap?" "What? Bean tea on my head, mother?" replied Job, slowly extricating one hand from a pocket, and feeling for the article in question, which he found on his head sure enough, and left there, to his mother's horror and Tom's great delight. Then there was poor Jacob Dodson, the half-witted boy, who ambled about cheerfully, undertaking messages and little helpful odds and ends for everyone, which, however, poor Jacob managed always hopelessly to embrangle. Everything came to pieces in his hands, and nothing would stop in his head. They nicknamed him Jacob Doodle Calf. But above all there was Harry Winburn, the quickest and best boy in the parish. He might be a year older than Tom, but was very little bigger, and he was the Crichton of our village boys. He could wrestle and climb and run better than all the rest, and learned all that the schoolmaster could teach him faster than that worthy at all liked. He was a boy to be proud of, with his curly brown hair, keen gray eye, straight active figure, and little ears and hands and feet, as fine as a lord's, as Charity remarked to Tom one day, talking, as usual, great nonsense. Lord's hands and ears and feet are just as ugly as other folks when they are children, as anyone may convince himself if he likes to look. Tight boots and gloves, and doing nothing with them, I allow make a difference by the time they are 20. Now that Benji was laid on the shelf, and his young brothers were still under petticoat government, Tom, in search of companions, began to cultivate the village boys generally more and more. Squire Brown, be it said, was a true blue Tory to the backbone, and believed honestly that the powers which be were ordained of God, and that loyalty and steadfast obedience were men's first duties. Whether it were in consequence or in spite of his political creed, I do not mean to give an opinion, though I have one, but certain it is that he held therewith divers social principles not generally supposed to be true blue in color. Foremost of these, and the one which the squire loved to propound above all others, was the belief that a man is to be valued wholly and solely for that which he is in himself, for that which stands up in the four fleshly walls of him, apart from clothes, rank, fortune, and all externals whatsoever. Which belief I take to be a wholesome corrective of all political opinions, and, if held sincerely, to make all opinions equally harmless, whether they be blue, red, or green. As a necessary corollary to this belief, Squire Brown held further that it didn't matter a straw whether his son associated with Lord's sons or Plowman's sons, provided they were brave and honest. He himself had played football and gone bird nesting with the farmers whom he met at Vestry and the laborers who tilled their fields, and so had his father and grandfather, with their progenitors. So he encouraged Tom in his intimacy with the boys of the village, and forwarded it by all means in his power, and gave them the run of a close for a playground, and provided bats and balls and a football for their sports. Our village was blessed amongst other things with a well-endowed school. The building stood by itself, apart from the master's house, on an angle of ground where three roads met, an old gray stone building with a steep roof and mullioned windows. On one of the opposite angles stood Squire Brown's stables and kennel, with their backs to the road, over which towered a great elm tree. On the third stood the village carpenter and wheelwright's large open shop, and his house and the schoolmaster's, with long low eaves, under which the swallows built by scores. The moment Tom's lessons were over, he would now get him down to this corner by the stables, and watch till the boys came out of school. He prevailed on the groom to cut notches for him in the bark of the elm so that he could climb into the lower branches, and there he would sit watching the school door, and speculating on the possibility of turning the elm into a dwelling place for himself and friends, after the manner of the Swiss family Robinson. But the school hours were long and Tom's patience short, so that he soon began to descend into the street, and go and peep in at the school door and the wheelwright's shop, and look out for something to while away the time. Now the wheelwright was a choleric man, and one fine afternoon, returning from a short absence, found Tom occupied with one of his pet adzes, the edge of which was fast vanishing under our hero's care. A speedy flight saved Tom from all but one sound cuff on the ears, but he resented this unjustifiable interruption of his first essays at carpentering, and still more the further proceedings of the wheelwright, who cut a switch, and hung it over the door of his workshop, threatening to use it upon Tom if he came within 20 yards of his gate. So Tom, to retaliate, commenced a war upon the swallows who dwelt under the wheelwright's eaves, whom he harassed with sticks and stones, and being fleeter of foot than his enemy, escaped all punishment, and kept him in perpetual anger. Moreover, his presence about the school door began to incense the master, as the boys in that neighborhood neglected their lessons in consequence, and more than once he issued into the porch, rod in hand, just as Tom beat a hasty retreat. And he and the wheelwright, laying their heads together, resolved to acquaint the squire with Tom's afternoon occupations, but in order to do it with effect, determined to take him captive and lead him away to judgment fresh from his evil doings. This they would have found some difficulty in doing, had Tom continued the war single-handed, or rather single-footed, for he would have taken to the deepest part of Pebbly Brook to escape them. But, like other active powers, he was ruined by his alliances. Poor Jacob Doodlecalf could not go to the school with the other boys, and one fine afternoon, about 3 o'clock, the school broke up at 4, Tom found him ambling about the street, and pressed him into a visit to the school porch. Jacob, always ready to do what he was asked, consented, and the two stole down to the school together. Tom first reconnoitred the wheelwright's shop, and seeing no signs of activity, thought all safe in that quarter, and ordered at once an advance of all his troops upon the school porch. The door of the school was ajar, and the boys seated on the nearest bench at once recognized and opened a correspondence with the invaders. Tom, waxing bold, kept putting his head into the school and making faces at the master when his back was turned. Poor Jacob, not in the least comprehending the situation, and in high glee at finding himself so near the school, which he had never been allowed to enter, suddenly, in a fit of enthusiasm, pushed by Tom, and ambling 3 steps into the school, stood there, looking round him and nodding with a self-approving smile. The master, who was stooping over a boy's slate, with his back to the door, became aware of something unusual, and turned quickly round. Tom rushed at Jacob, and began dragging him back by his smock frock, and the master made at them, scattering forms and boys in his career. Even now they might have escaped, but that in the porch, barring retreat, appeared the crafty wheelwright, who had been watching all their proceedings. So they were seized, the school dismissed, and Tom and Jacob led away to Squire Brown as lawful prize, the boys following to the gate in groups, and speculating on the result. The squire was very angry at first, but the interview